Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
What I was just checking was, because you're from Omaha.
That's correct.
And I just interviewed Adam Devine. And
oh, yeah.
He's from Omaha, too.
He is also from Omaha. Yeah,
we didn't know each other because you're young. Or he's,
no, he's, you were going to say it, but yes, he is younger.
He's younger than I am. Listen, everyone's younger than me these days, which is, I used to be the young one, and now I'm the oldest all the time, so.
No.
Well,
there's older out there. But Adam and I met, we didn't meet until we were both in LA. And then we worked on, I think the first thing we worked on together was a movie called Why Him with Bryan Cranston that we did. We both just had sort of like little parts in and we were on the set together. And then later we did The Intern together with Nancy Myers. And we had a couple, I don't think we had scenes together, but we were on set together a lot and during that process. But, and then as it always happens in life, then anytime I went to Omaha for like a holiday or something, I would see him in the airport or I would see him like at a restaurant, like never saw him before, but then all of a sudden.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that just happens.
It does just happen. But we used to see each other at an airport bar in Omaha called Cracky McGee's.
Oh, it's one of those bars that serves crack?
Yes, it was a crack
bar. An Irish bar. An Irish crack bar.
But yes.
Oh, boy.
From Omaha. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we've already started, by the way. This is, I'm talking to Andrew Rannells, who, are you Andrew all the time, or are you ever Andy?
I am Andy at home in Omaha. So I was just in Omaha for 4th of July, and I'm still very much an Andy. But we can't have two Andys on this interview.
Well, I mean, I'm still waiting to see if Andy Williams will be on.
Oh, that'd be great.
I can't remember if he's still alive.
Well, if he's not, that'd be even more of a get.
I want to ask him about the whole Coke spoon thing. I mentioned it, Omaha. I mean, it's actually, people hear Omaha, Nebraska, and they think snooze. When actually it's kind of a bustling metropolis, is it not?
It is. It's a bustling metropolis. And I have to say, every time I go back, I was 19 when I moved, so I was not like fully aware of like what the city had to offer. But over the past, 25 years going back, they really do a nice job of revitalizing like their downtown area. And there's a big suburban sprawl there, but they also, they do a nice job of like actually using the space that they have and using older buildings, and which I appreciate. I appreciate that they use those old neighborhoods. And now there's a lot of like, young, fun, like little hipster folk running around.
Yeah. Isn't that weird?
It's like, really weird.
For me, it's more the suburbs of Chicago, but there seem to be like hipsters in the suburbs of Chicago, which I just am like, what are you doing out here? Shouldn't you be?
Yeah,
shouldn't you go somewhere else?
No, I guess you can you can be a hipster anywhere, it turns out.
Yeah, no, it seems like that. My son is an artist. He's just finishing up college, and he talks about how there's amazing art opportunities in Tulsa.
Really?
They are trying to attract artists with incentives or grants or something to come populate downtown Tulsa, which is not what you'd expect from Tulsa.
No, but that's, you know? That's very cool. You know, I felt like, and I don't know if you felt the same, like when I was in high school, specifically I wanted to be on Broadway. So there's only one place to do that, and that is New York City. So I had no other option to do that. But I see it with my nieces and nephews now that, like, you know, there are more options like that. For me, it was like I had tunnel vision on New York.
Yeah.
I was like, I got to go to New York. And now it seems like there's other places you can go.
But that Broadway, it is so. That's it. I mean, where else are you going to go? Yeah. Nowhere. I mean, I guess maybe London, but.
True.
You know, because there's, you know, in terms of English language theater, it would be kind of London. But even then.
Well, and I wanted to do musical theater, which is so specifically American. Yes, it exists in the West End, but that is a very American thing to focus on. I didn't have the skill set for Shakespeare, Andy. I was not I couldn't do it.
I don't have the attention span Shakespeare.
I've run into a lot of issues with this, and I always say the wrong thing. Like, I remember having a conversation with Oscar Eustace, who runs the Public Theater, and he asked me about, like, doing Shakespeare in the Park, and I said, why? Which, my friend Nikki James was with me, and she was horrified because she's done several shows at the Delacorte in the summer, and I was like, I can't do that. I just can't.
All the words.
It's so much. You gotta remember. So much talking, not enough faces. Yes. Come on.
Well, I don't think it's true, because I think the last Shakespeare thing I saw was a Shakespeare in the Park, which I am like a fan of stagecraft and art direction. Like, I do like shows, you know, I like any of that Cirque du Soleil stuff. I'm there for the you know, like, all of a sudden the stage opens up and there's a 15-foot diving pool. You know, like, that shit I love.
Amazing.
And, yeah. But I saw, I think it was A Midsummer Night's Dream, and it was one more than I said, but because previous to that, I went and saw Shakespeare, somebody else's idea, and I just sat there and I thought, I'm a grown man. I don't have to do this. Like, I don't have to do this anymore. Like, and if somebody were to say, like, oh, he's the great, I'd be saying, like, okay, that's great for you, but I do not get much out of this.
Well, there you go.
I don't know what they're talking about half the time.
It's a lot
and
of,
I think that's useful.
It's a lot of, you know, code deciphering sometimes.
Yes.
Which I think people really enjoy. On a certain level, it's fun to do sometimes. But yeah, because I was introduced to a lot of that material by way of musicals, like, I remember the first time seeing, like, a production of Romeo and Juliet and being like, oh, that's Maria. And that's Tony. And that's
Riff. Oh, I thought you were going to talk about Kiss Me, Kate or something.
Well,
you
know? But I put it with West Side Story. I was like, oh, okay. Yeah. Now I understand what's happening.
I understand.
Throw some songs in there. It. Now I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to go, just because it crossed my mind, and I think when you were, like, when you left Omaha to go to New York City, I mean, like you said, you only had one choice where you could really go to do what you wanted to do. But was there also kind of a, like, I got to get out of Omaha?
Yeah, no, I definitely felt that pressure. Yeah. I mean, I think for a few reasons, like, wanting to be an actor, number one, being gay was a big one too. Like, I was like, I can't really imagine what my life was going to be like here, you know, especially in the 90s in Omaha. I was like, I can't see it working out. Now I don't know would probably be a lot of different options, but yeah, at the time, yeah, I felt like I gotta get out of here. And I did think about, like, a couple other places. Like, I thought, well, maybe I could go to, I remember going to visit, the San Francisco State, that campus. Cause I was, you know, like a lot of teenage boys who go to all boys Catholic schools, I was really obsessed with Jack Kerouac, and I was like, I'm going to San Francisco and finding some Benzies, and I'm gonna, I'm gonna live yeah. in San Francisco. And I got there.
I'm gonna be one of the cool kinds of alcoholics.
Yeah, I want to just hitchhike. Yeah, but I got there and I was like, this isn't for me. I just gotta go. I gotta go to New York. But I did think about it for about a month. I was like, maybe I'll go to San Francisco first. But it didn't. It didn't work out. It didn't work out.
When? Was there an age when you knew, like, okay, I gotta be in Broadway. I gotta in on. With Broadway, you know, I got to soak it up.
Yeah, I was watching the Tony Awards one summer, and, you know, pre-internet, it was like that was the one window of time a kid from the, you know, Midwest or anywhere outside of New York could see what was happening on Broadway were the Tony Awards. And I watched this number from a musical called Falsettos, and it's this great musical that James Lapine and William Finn wrote, and it was nominated for a Tony that year, and they did this performance, and it was not only really funny and really cool, but it was also about gay people, and like the two leads of it were gay, and I was like, I gotta do that. That's what I want to do. And piecing that together in my mind, like, I guess that's the... I'm going to do musical theater on Broadway, and that's going to be what I do.
Yeah.
That's my job.
Did you vocalize that to anybody?
I did, and like a lot of kids who vocalize things like that, I was told it was nonsense.
Yeah.
That I needed a backup plan.
Because it kind of is.
It kind of is nonsense. I know.
They're not wrong.
They're not, you know. They're not incorrect, but I was told all through high school and that like that was not, you know, I should have a backup plan and I should, I should really. And my parents were, they didn't come on too strong about that in terms of like, you should study something else in addition. Like they just kind of let me figure out like what school I was going to go to and how I was going to pay for it. And like, you know, I got scholarships and I auditioned for, you know, like any sort of grant I could get at that time, like to pay for school. And they were very supportive, but they just didn't really know how to do it. You know, they didn't have any, they didn't have any of that info. So I sort of made that plan and did it. And I remember getting into school and being like, well, I got a full scholarship to this school in New York City, and I'm moving in August, and that was it. And I just told them, and they were like, "Oh, okay. Well, best of luck. Good luck with that." And they took me to New York, and they literally dropped me off at a dorm.
Yeah.
And that was it. And they were on their way.
I mean, I have older kids, and now you know, I just got married to somebody that had a daughter, so I have a 22-year-old, a 17-year-old, and a 3-year-old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so like I'm really kind of looking, you know, I've been thinking a lot about parenting in a very holistic kind of way. And I just wonder, with that kind of light touch approach that your parents had, kind of like without stating any heavy preference for what they expected of you, were you okay with that at the time? Did that seem like, did you want them to kind of push you in one direction or another, or, you know, or was it just kind of, that's how it was and why worry about it?
I mean, that's a good question. I think at the time I was really determined and I was very focused on what I wanted to do. And because they maybe didn't have the experience or the sort of vocabulary that I needed, particularly when it came to studying acting or, you know, the arts in general, like they didn't know a lot about that. And they told me that they were like, this is, we can't really help you a ton when it comes to like picking out we don't know what you're looking for. We don't know what the best answer is. And again, this was at a time where like, it wasn't a simple Google search away of, you know, well, what is a liberal arts education in New York City? Or, you know, so at times, yes, I would have loved them to have been more hands-on and more maybe dug in with me a little bit more when it came to the research and it came to things like that. Now, long-term, I would say having to do that on my own did make me more determined.
Yeah.
And it did make me... I mean, I there was no room for failure when I got to New York because I was like, well, this is the plan that I made and I don't have a backup. And I very much kind of had that, not in a resentful way, but in a I'll show them, Like, I'll show them that I can do this. I'll show them that I can make these decisions. And, you know, it's lonely at times. It was scary at times. And I made a lot of mistakes. But, like, and my mother hates hearing about it now that, you know, some of those years that were pretty lean and bleak in New York, like, she does not like to hear about those. But that was all part of making a life. You know what I mean? Like, that was just
what does she not like about it? Does it seem to seem it reflects on her mothering or something?
No, I think that she just doesn't like to think about me upset or lonely or depressed, or, you know, the idea that she was in Nebraska and I'm, you know, far away in New York City, you know, alone, sort of struggling. But, like, at the time, I don't know how you feel about it, but when you're in your early 20s like that, I didn't necessarily feel like I was, like, struggling. I was just sort of in the middle of it. So I didn't feel horribly depressed by it. But, like, yes, and when looking back on that kid and being like, well, yeah, there were some tough years there. But when you're in the throes of it, I don't know, you're just kind of doing it. And everyone around me was doing it. So,
right. And I think that's what, you know, that's like, you know, the transition from child to adult, it can be really miserable. And I mean, and like, in a way that is garden variety, you know, it's like, you know what I mean? It's like, I know that's really stressful and really awful. And sometimes you feel like, what's the point of it all? And you don't know if you're going to make it through it, but that's what happens. That's how it,
So your 22-year-old son, yes?
That's, yes.
So
yes.
When he comes to you with those thoughts or those feelings, like, do you say, like, you got to just kind of roll through it?
Yeah. And I don't think that it's a very helpful answer, but I mean, I don't know what else to tell him.
I know. Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. He has my same, you know, whether you call it ADD or just like, I just can't get homework done. Gotcha. Like, I have real troubles getting homework done. And until the very last minute, and even then, get an extension on the last minute. So I get another last minute. And he definitely has that same thing. And thank God, like, his younger sister doesn't, because she once told me, like, why doesn't he just do a little bit of his work every night rather than leaving it all right till the end? And I was like, that's like saying, why doesn't that alcoholic just stop drinking? You know, I'm like, because that's just not how it is.
No.
And he you know, I've tried to commiserate with him and say, I know what you're going through. And there's no magic answer. You just kind of, you got to do your homework.
Yeah.
You know, it just, you got to, and however you can find, and, you know, there's different strategies that, you know, specialists will tell you, but it's like, no, you just got to do it. And and being worried about the future and being worried, you know, frankly, now, you know, he's transitioning into an area where, you know, he's, I'm not paying for everything.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, and that transition is very difficult, but it's like, well, of course you're not going to starve and you're not going to be homeless, but you really got to figure out how to make money, you know?
And that's very much what my parents did to me or for me was that I was just responsible for all of that when I got to New York. So it's, you know, it's daunting, but I think if I had kids that were at that age, like, I would, you know, I would help when I could, but for the most part, you do, eventually you're going to have to figure it out. So I don't know is it a better lesson to learn at 21? Because I've seen people, I've worked with people, I grew up with people who, like, whose parents sort of, you know, helped them all through their 20s, and then they still go through it at 30. And it's not a good look to be like 32 and be like, I don't know how to pay my bills. You're like, that's not.
How do you write a check?
Yeah. Like, I was lucky that I figured that out, you know, early, but I was resentful of my peers whose parents helped them, who paid, who paid for apartments and they had allowances. And now, you know, at 44, I'm like, well, I'm actually glad my parents didn't do that, because I had to sort that out on my own. And I'm glad that they didn't, because everybody has to go through it at some point. Unless you're like a trust fund kid who just can always do that.
Right, exactly. Then you've got a lifelong teat to nurse from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you get to New York and have to get like a series of shitty jobs?
Yeah, I did all the shitty jobs. The only thing that I didn't really do was wait tables because I was not qualified. I mean, it turns out it's like kind of hard to get a waiting job in New York.
Yeah.
They want references and I couldn't do that. So I was a host at several restaurants. I did coat check. I worked at some gyms. I worked at the Warner Brothers store as a greeter. That was a real low point.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
That was,
you gotta, oh
yeah.
Talk about acting.
Oh my God. And then, you know, mixed in, I did all of those horrible things that like young performers do, like handing out like promotional flyers. Like I remember doing that in Times Square for the Big Apple Circus and being like, you know, 20 years old maybe, and having to like wear some like dumb sweatshirt and be like, do you guys like clowns? Like, who wants to see the circus? And like, and just like standing in the cold with like a stack full of flyers, nobody wanted to talk to me. For some reason I was paired with a girl who took it very seriously. And mm-hmm. I just started slowly throwing my flyers away in street trash cans and was like, fuck this. And she was like, Andrew, you can't throw them away. We have to pass them out. And I was just like chucking them. And it was like, see you later, Lindsay.
Yeah. Look, I'm done for the day.
I'm going home. Terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Terrible. Terrible.
That is. Well, you mentioned you in your new book, Uncle of the Year. You mentioned that you know when you got there, you did start going through the audition process.
Yeah,
and then you do say you did fairly well with voiceover.
Yeah, yeah.
And did that start fairly early on, or was that kind of?
That started when I was in Omaha, actually, and I did a lot of work at this as a kid at this children's theater, and through this weird series of events, this company called Deke, DIC, that at the time was owned by Disney, who made Saturday morning cartoons, came to Omaha to audition some actors to see if they could do what I now understand was non-union voiceover work. I didn't know from a union at 16 years old. Right. So
they just say, do you want to read these things that'll be on TV?
And yes.
You go, yes.
So I got a job. I got a Saturday morning cartoon that, that recorded in Omaha. And we did it for a while, for like all through high school. And then a couple more series came my way. And this was all in Omaha, which is pretty crazy. So then, and I did commercials and things like that. So then when I got to New York, I really wanted to keep doing that. And I was able to do some of it through that company, through Deke. But then I got hooked up with this company called 4Kids Entertainment that did like Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh! And they had all of these shows that they were producing in like around 2000, 2001. And so I just kind of jumped on their bandwagon. And that became like my real like sort of day job, quote unquote, while I was auditioning for theater. Was doing these.
Is this in New York? Or is this still in Omaha?
This was in New York. Yeah. All the Pokemon stuff was in New York.
Do you have copies of those? Like, or, you know,
they're floating around. Yeah.
Seen kids watching a Pokemon cartoon and being like, that's me.
Yeah. Those kids. Yeah. Because they weren't even born when I was doing it. And now all of that stuff is on YouTube. And so I get kids who come up with like playing cards, and like they've tracked me down on a lot of these weird shows.
Wow.
Yeah. It's very humbling. But super grateful that that was my job, you know, that I got to do that for a long time. Yeah.
It's great work. I love doing voiceover. Like I'm just at the point, like if I could make a living just doing voiceover, I would be absolutely okay with that, you know.
I mean, I'm, you know, lucky that I still get to do a lot of it. Yeah, I do a lot, still do a lot of animation and some commercial stuff. And yeah, I love doing it. It's real fun. It's real fun to do.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
You know, you mentioned that you know, when you first got to New York City, that transition from Omaha, live with your folks, to New York City, Broadway, which can chew you up and spit you out. And New York City, which can chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that New York City gay life can chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah.
I mean, was there ever a point where you thought about giving up, or where you thought, whether you just felt like this is too much?
I had like 1 hour where I thought I should seriously go move to Orlando and work at a theme park. I remember thinking that at one point, being like, my life would be so much easier if I just worked in a theme park. And because
you'd have dental.
Yeah. I had friends that went and did it, and I was like, I should maybe just do that, but I didn't do that. But I did. I had a handful of like really close calls for different Broadway shows and didn't get them, and was feeling really discouraged. And at 23, was feeling really old and really like just kind of like beat around. And I was like, it's never going to happen for me. Like, I should just stop. And that's when I accepted a job at that 4 Kids Entertainment directing cartoons. And I became like, I directed 2 series for about 2.5 years. I worked for them and stopped.
Voice direction or the direction of the whole thing?
Voice direction. They were acquired shows mostly from Japan that we just had to redub. So there was like a little bit of like editing work that I had to sort of like figure out in terms of like, but whatever, for timing. And, but most of it was just the voiceover direction. Which I liked, and it was very stable, and there was insurance, and there was a retirement plan, and there were all of these things that I was like, it's so nice just to have a paycheck. But after about 2.5 years of that, I was like, I'm not done. I was I was 25, and I was like, I want to go back to auditioning. And then,
was it keeping you from auditioning? The schedule didn't allow?
It was because I mean, it was a full time. I mean, there were long days of recording. So yeah, there was no room to like skip out for an audition. So, but then I quit that job, and I quit rather impulsively. I walked into my boss's office and I was like, I'm going to give my 2 weeks notice. I mean, there was no contract or anything. It was just, and I quit and said, you know, I told them what I wanted to do, that I was like, I want to try this Broadway thing again, and I want to audition. And they literally laughed at me, that they were like, that's,
what?
Yeah, they were like, that's, I mean, best of luck, but this is a huge mistake and you can always come back. And then I quit and just started auditioning, and I did one show off Broadway. which was pretty terrible, but really fun, called It's Karate Kid, the musical. And but while I was doing that, then I got an audition for a Broadway show for Hairspray. And that was the first Broadway show that I booked. So
yeah.
It ended up working out. But, you know, it was a real... I just had to sort of trust my gut on that one and be like, I can't stay on this job. I remembered at 25, I was like, you moved here to do one thing and you've lost sight of it. And you need to give it another shot before you call it a day. So
were there people in your life who were sort of saying to you, you know, aren't you going to get back to that? Did you have encouragement from people to kind of say, like, what are you doing just directing the cartoons?
I did. Yeah, I did. But it was mostly just like an anxiety that was growing inside of me that was.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that I had it's funny to think about that at 23, I was like, I'm too old to continue.
Yes.
And then at 25, something clicked that I was like, you're not that old. Get out there.
Yeah. And you can really, I think even now too, I think the world is different just in terms of ages. Cause I think you can fuck around like all the way up to 30. you can really kind of, don't give up. Keep trying. You know, and by fuck around, I just mean keep trying on the long shot.
Yeah.
You know, you got to pay bills and stuff, but you don't have to really.
No. You don't have to lock it in.
Settle. Yeah. No. You don't have to settle. When you get to 30, like I do think there is a point where you do, sometimes you got to settle. Like you got to go, look, maybe I'm not going to be an astronaut.
Yeah.
And so I'll stop. I mean, I have the suit, I know, but I don't. So far, NASA is not calling. I also wanted to ask, because you mentioned it about like, I can only imagine what it's like to be young and gay from Omaha and move to New York City.
Yeah.
And can you speak to like what, you know, what that meant to your identity, and like, were you excited? Were you terrified? Were you all those things? Because it certainly is a lot easier to be gay in New York City.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I was all of those things. It took me a while to sort of figure out what my life was going to look like in general in New York. You know, I was in school. And so a lot of those questions were sort of answered for me in terms of like where I was living and what my days looked like. I was going to, I was in classes all day and had a job at night. And I found myself like a really cute, like liberal arts boyfriend who was like really sort of like moody. And, you know, it was like, it was great. So like my first
moody and unemployed, like liberal arts people are.
Yeah. He was like he was like a year older. He was like real 90s looking, like he was cute. And so that was fun, and I did all of that. But it wasn't until a few years after I left school and was working that I really kind of figured out, like, what that gay scene was for me. Because, you know, coming out in the 90s or becoming aware of my sexuality in the 90s, especially, like, within the context of, like, community theater in Omaha and stuff, there was a lot of... big picture, there was a lot of fear about AIDS at the time and HIV.
Yeah.
So sex seemed still very dangerous to me in my mind at that age. And some of the examples that I had around me, you know, of guys, adults that were doing, you know, community theater with me, a lot of them were sick. And that scared the hell out of me that could potentially be. Is that my future? Is that what, you know, is that what being gay means? These are all, you know, questions I had as like a very young person. So then by the time
Catholic stuff enter into that too, like, you know, or can you separate that?
I didn't feel No, I didn't feel like judgment from the Catholic Church. Like, I don't know why. Even though I was raised very Catholic and was an altar boy and went to Catholic school and all of that, like, I kind of was like, whatever. When it came to them saying, yeah, like, you're going to hell, I was like, cool, cool. I didn't, yeah, I wasn't.
Okay.
Yeah, I okay, wasn't, thanks. I don't know, I wasn't super conflicted about that. I was like,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And I think because in high school, and I wrote about this in my first book, that like I had a handful of run-ins with some real grabby priests, and like super hypocritical, like clearly gay, like obviously like gay priests that were like real fucking handsy. And so I kind, by the time I was like graduating high school, I was like, fuck off. Like whatever they were saying about like, we don't, we condemn that. I was like, sure you do.
Yeah, sure you do.
Like I remember going, I remember running into the president of my all boys Catholic school at like an after hours gay club in Omaha. And he was wearing a fucking glow stick necklace around his neck. And he like, he saw me and he was like, are you supposed to be in here? I said, I don't know, Father, are you supposed to be in here? Cause like I had snuck in and I was like,
what the fucking nerve I to know. Say to you,
are you supposed to are be you, in here?
I'm doing research for my book on sin.
I'm preaching to these young men. So yes, but it did take me, it was like not until I was probably in my early 20s that then I like found my group of gays to hang out with in New York. And then it became fun and I, you know, and I talk about it in this book a little bit of finding, you know, going out to clubs and like finding bars to go to and having sex with people and dating people. And like that, there was a little bit of a delayed adolescence when it came to that stuff. I was like into my 20s before I found that. And then by the time I hit Broadway, that whole group of people, that's a real fun, that's a fun place to be, you know, young and gay. Is Broadway.
Yeah, I bet.
It's Broadway.
I bet.
Broadway. I highly recommend it.
Oh, if I had it all to do over.
Yes. To be a young gay chorus boy.
Did you mention it in the book kind of that you had difficulty, and you said you found your group of gays.
Yeah.
And, you know, and did you not, it seems like you had mostly female friends prior to that.
Yes, that is correct. Yeah.
And is that, do you think that's a common thing with young gay kids in smaller towns? And what, is there something that's keeping you from being friends with,
with boys,
you know, with boys, gay or straight?
I think some of it is the fear of being like found out. I think I learned pretty early that, you know, hanging out with other boys and not, you know, being that athletic, not being, you know, not being like a typical little boy. I mean, the word faggot starts getting thrown around pretty quickly.
It sure does.
So then I was like, especially in like the 80s and the 90s, I was like, okay, so I learned that, and I was lucky that, like, in my small Catholic school, there, it turns out, were two other gay boys, and so the three of us became, like, a little gay clique, and would talk about, like, Kids Incorporated and Knots Landing, and, you know, we're quite popular Kids in our own right. And
my wife is almost like just about 10 years younger than me, and Kids Incorporated has come up, you know, she mentions it at least once every couple of weeks. There's something like, oh, she was on Kids Incorporated, or, you know, or she'll send me clips from Kids Incorporated, which just, it seemed like such a, like a factory
God.
Making, you know, weird little showbiz kids that don't fit anywhere in the world.
So strange. Well, I would be happy to talk to your wife anytime about Kids Incorporated. Anytime she wants to talk about it.
She remembers the personalities, the names, you know.
Well, Fergie was on.
Right.
Not the Duchess of York, but the
Black-eyed Fergie. Yeah.
She was on Kids Incorporated.
Yeah.
So
it's so such a strange
success. Thing. And Jennifer Love Hewitt and Mario Lopez. Like there were some people came out of Kids Incorporated.
Right. It was fertile ground If only you could have been there, you know, then maybe you would have made something of yourself.
Don't you think I didn't want that? I mean, that and the new Mickey Mouse Club. I was like, please, baby Jesus, if there's some way for me to get on the new Mickey Mouse Club. It never happened.
Yeah. But God, that was another one. That was another one. It was a Justin Timberlake, Britney Spears.
Carrie Russell.
Wasn't Christina Aguilera in that too?
Yeah. She was on there. I mean, there's a lot of people. Ryan Gosling. Yeah.
Oh, right.
I would love to see a reunion of the new Mickey Mouse Club, if anyone could put that together. Because I know for every like shiny example of stardom there are some kids who also fell through the cracks. And I would love to catch up with all of them. You know, I just want to see where everyone is. How's everyone doing?
Yeah, you put your Justin Timberlake in the same room with like one of his co-stars who's now managing a Fridays.
Yeah.
You know, that would be interesting.
And I want to do it like, you know, like Andy Cohen style, you know, just couches and people really just like going at it, like just have at it, just have at each other. Let's get them all out there. I'm happy to host. I'm happy to watch whatever it takes.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network. So whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at the coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a crow?
You started to get some, well, I mean, touring shows. You were like in Jersey Boys and stuff like that. Which, by the way, how did you take to life on the road? Like, was it one-nighters or were you going somewhere and staying for a few months or weeks?
I did. So the first tour I did was Pokemon Live.
Okay.
Which was very not fun. I was 21 at the time though. So I was like, whatever.
Yeah.
We started at Radio City and we did like 6 weeks at Radio City, which seemed cool.
Wow.
Or maybe it was like whatever it was. It was like 4 weeks, 6 weeks, something like that. And then we went on this tour, which was mostly 1 week sit downs, which is pretty cushy. And then it became like split weeks where we were doing like, you know, two nights in Duluth and then driving to like Moline and then driving to then it started to get a little, that was not great. But years later, when I was doing Jersey Boys on tour, that was like the cushiest tour ever because you sat down for like a month in every city. So, you know, a month in Chicago and a month in San Francisco. And like that was pretty easy. And then we did 4 months in Toronto. So like that tour, I liked touring a little bit. Like I learned a lot sort of opening a show in every city. And they were skills that I didn't know I would need, but then like became very useful when I started, you know, even still doing publicity for stuff. Like a lot of that is stuff that I learned on tour to do Wake Up Cleveland. And, you know, you're doing like a cooking segment, but also talking about Frankie Valli. It's, there's not
because nobody teaches you how to do that.
There's not a class for that. And it's 5 a.m. and you're, you know, singing on local television. It's like, that's tough. But
and it's a big part of what you do, especially like for television. If you get a job, you know, you study acting, you study performing, you study auditions, you study, you know, you might even be sort of like knowledgeable about the production of a television show, which informs your acting skills. And then all of a sudden it's like, here you go. Here's, you know, like they call them satellite interviews for people that don't know. Here's 10 different morning hosts, one after the other.
Oof.
Be charming and funny to them, you know.
That was a real, I remember doing those in San Francisco for Jersey Boys, and like specifically, like it was the first time I had ever done anything like that. And they, the guest before us on many of these, on these shows was the guy who ran the Bunny Ranch.
Oh, right.
Dennis something was his name. I think he's since passed away, but he has. He was promoting the show on HBO, which I think was called Cat House. And then it was like the boys from Jersey Boys. And it was such a weird, I was like, how do we transition out of this? Like, how do we get from, I don't know. It was like, it was that learning how to do that and those, especially the really loud morning shows where it's like,
yes,
you just hear like animal noises and car horns and like, there's all sorts of sound effects and shit. And you're like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah. Yeah.
And you just, yeah, have
the
to,
especially the radio.
Oh
the radio
my God.
Ones,
the radio
know,
ones
it's
are,
like, you know, like, you know, big man and booger or whatever, you know, like just awful, awful people yep. that come on like, yeah. hey, buddy.
It's usually like two horrible men and then like big man and booger and Lindsay. And you're like, it's some like
who just giggles.
Yeah. She's like a nice woman who like tries to answer, you know, asks the questions and the other guys
tries to
just
humanize the big man and the booger
and the booger. Yeah. So that was but it was a good lesson. Very good lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you kind of, you know, you were making your living you quit that Pokemon directing job for a good reason because you were making a living, but Book of Mormon is what really
that
planted
changed.
You in the public consciousness. And I'm wondering, is there like specific ways that like when you could realize like, oh shit, it's different now.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. When, I mean, the people that were coming to see the show, the celebrities that were coming, the actors, the directors, the writers, that really sort of was very eye-opening. The fact that every night we were meeting people and all of a sudden Josh and I are getting like, you know, taken out to dinners and that was moved very quickly and was really heady. And then when the you know, requests, you know, to come to Los Angeles to meet with, you know, showrunners and producers. And that was also really, I don't want to say that I wasn't prepared for it. It just like, and it sounds silly to say it happened so quickly because it was like 12 years after I moved to New York.
Yeah.
But just with like the opening of one show that all of a sudden it was like, and now you're going to go to LA and you're going to meet with these people. And, you know, the hope is that you end this trip with a pilot. And, you know, there was just definitely, it's like the finish line sort of moved very quickly. And all of a sudden I was developing like a new skill set of how to take general meetings, which I had never done before. And like, didn't know what the hell I was talking about. And luckily the other crazy thing that happened right after we opened the Book of Mormon was that this young woman named Lena Dunham, asked if I would be a part of this television show that she was doing that nobody really mm-hmm. knew anything about. And so we filmed the first season of Girls while I was still in the Book of Mormon. And then I went away to LA after we finished that just for a week. I took a week's vacation and like took a bunch of meetings and I stayed with Lena while she was editing the first season. And she sort of talked me through general meetings because she had just done it all after she released Tiny Furniture, which, you know, got her Girls. And I'm so grateful to her that I was staying with her and she would sort of coach me through all of these meetings. I'd be like, this is my list of all. And I just gotten I had signed with Jimmy Miller. You know, mm-hmm. Jimmy Miller.
He's a manager
and represents a lot of comics and actors and writers. And so I was working with him and he and Christy Smith, you know, my manager still, like they set up all these meetings. And so every night Lena we would go through and she'd be like, okay, well, I don't know this person. I do know who that is. And like, you just have to be, you know, we would sort of talk about what I was going to wear, what I was going to talk about, what I was going to, you know, her other funny piece of advice that I write about in this book is she was like, everyone's going to offer you water. they're going to give you a water bottle. And so just take the water at every meeting. Just say, thank you, I'll have a water. And she was like, it's the water bottle tour. Like, that's what this is. And she was right. Like, in the back of my Chevy, you know, Cobalt that I had rented for the week, it was just littered with like every kind of bottled water you could possibly have. Yeah. She was like, take the water, just do it.
Yeah.
Don't ask for anything else. Don't ask for a coffee. Yeah. Don't ask for.
Don't drink it.
Don't drink
it. For God's sakes, don't drink it. Just take it and take it with you.
Take the water. Yeah. So that was the, that was sort of the moment that I knew. I was like, oh, the Book of Mormon really changed everything. Like, this is pretty nuts all of a sudden.
Yeah. Well, it was, I mean, it's, you know, when you think about like, what are the things I've laughed hardest at? And it's one of the things I've laughed. Yeah. It's such a funny show. I got to see you in it.
Yeah.
In New York. Yeah. I took my son. And I got to see you in it. But that night, Josh's understudy was on, whose name I don't remember, but I was.
His name was Jared Gertner. Very, very. He ended up taking over for Josh. Yeah, he played the role. Super. Yeah, Josh. I mean, it was just, and Josh was going through the same thing that I was going through.
Like, yeah, yeah.
We both left that show. We left at the same time to go both shoot pilots for NBC. We left the show at the same time when those pilots got picked up. We went back to New York after our shows were canceled. Like we went through that whole experience together of like having, it's why it's, you know, we're still very close, and we're doing a show together on Broadway this fall called Gutenberg the Musical, and
I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, it's the first time that we've worked together since the Book of Mormon, and we've done little things here and there, but like this will be the first time, and it's Josh's first time back on Broadway. So, I couldn't be more excited about it, but it's pretty. It's just amazing that, you know, 12 years later, we get this opportunity to come back and do a show together while the Book of Mormon is still running on Broadway,
oh, wow.
by the way. So it's a nice feeling to know that that legacy continues. It's also weird to think that like, oh yeah, we started that and the people who were playing those parts were probably like 10 when the show opened.
Those fuckers. Tell me how that came about. Like, what did somebody have the show Gutenberg? Did you guys say, hey, we should develop something to do for ourselves?
Well, we had been, Josh and I had both sort of been independent. I mean, we have talked about doing things together for many, many years. And we both are a huge fan of Alex Timbers, the director Alex Timbers, and had both been sort of pursuing him separately about different projects. And then Alex came to us with a show called Gutenberg, the Musical, written by Scott Brown and Anthony King, that had been produced off-Broadway many years ago, Alex was a part of, and he was like, I think this is the thing for both of you. So we both read it and we're like, this seems, you know, hilariously funny. We put together a reading of it here in Los Angeles in March of 2020.
Fundraising kind of thing?
It was just for us to sort of work through it. And
yeah.
So we did it and we sort of tried it on for size and we were like, we both really liked it, and we found some producers, and then Broadway shut down because of COVID, and that all went away. And then, but we kept talking about it, and we kept, you know, Alex and Josh and I kept sort of, you know, speaking, and Scott and Anthony, we all talked about it. And then the timing just all kind of clicked together that this fall was going to be the time that sort of worked for everyone. And we did another reading of it, and J.J. Abrams has come on board. Also, is our producer, and so we're gonna take it to the Broadway now. After all of that,
you play multiple characters, both of you, correct?
We do. The show is, it's, I mean, I think it's hilarious. It's two very well-meaning guys who want to write a show. They want to write a musical, and they think, they're big fans of musicals. They think they know what works, and what they think would work best is a musical about a historical figure. So they just kind of randomly pick Johann Gutenberg, the inventor of the printing press.
Yes.
And it turns out there's not much known about Johann Gutenberg. So then they figure, fuck it, we'll just start making some stuff up. So they create the show, you know, they're presenting it to an audience for the first time as sort of a backers audition. And they're gonna try to find some producers. They've rented this Broadway theater for one night, and they put all of their resources into this one performance of the show, and they're gonna try to sell the hell out of it. But the problem is they don't have money for a full cast or a full band or a full set. So we're just kind of winging it. We're just kind of winging it.
Playing all the parts.
So
yourself.
We get to play all of the parts, and they range from like children to old men to like, it's really fun. And I just get to, you know, fuck around with Josh Gad on stage for 2 hours. So that'll be nice.
That sounds really nice. And how long, how big a slot do you have for it to run in your schedule?
Well, we'll be,
like, how long can you do it?
It's 20 weeks. So we start in September, and then we close January 28th is our closing date. So it's a nice, healthy 20 weeks to get in there. You know, I think
autumn in New York is always, it's
fantastic.
The best time,
you know,
Christmas time, beautiful
the holidays, that holiday show schedule. Yeah. Yeah.
That's nice. Well, is there stuff that's kind of been left undone for you? I mean, what do you want to do, you know, in the future? Is it kind of just, you know, continue on the same track that you've set, or?
I mean, the short answer is I'm not sure. And any time that I've tried to plan that I've like busted out a vision board and like, this is what's going to happen next, it's never quite worked out the way that I thought. And I think like the best example of that is getting to write these books. And that I you know, wrote a book a few years ago called Too Much Is Not Enough. And the fact that I was given another opportunity to write a second book, you know, that just Uncle of the Year that just came out, like, that's not something that I ever thought I would get the chance to do. And I'd always loved writing, and I loved to write, and I was always very nervous to share anything I had written, and then slowly was kind of, you know, coaxed out of that by various people. And, you know, so that was that was a big surprise that I got to do that. So
yeah.
I don't quite know what's next, because as I said, you know, usually when you plan, it's a good way to not have it go that way. So I don't know. Hopefully definitely more writing and coming back to Broadway after, I mean, the last Broadway show I did was The Boys in the Band. And what was that? 2019, 2018. Well, something like that. And
well, 18. If it was pre-COVID. Yeah.
Pre-COVID. Yeah. I think it was 18. Yeah, yeah. So this has been a very long time since I've been back on Broadway. So I'm very excited.
You met your partner, Tuck Watkins.
That's at that. Boys in the Band.
In that point. And Tuck and I knew Tuck years ago when I first came to LA.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, because he has kids.
He does. He has two kids.
What's that been like for you, you know, to kind of be dad's boyfriend?
Yeah. I mean, it's not anything that I had sort of seen on the vision board, that I would be dating somebody with 10-year-old twins. And it certainly comes with, you know, challenges, as you know, with children. It turns out, kids have minds of their own. And they have a lot of fucking opinions.
Yeah, and they sure do. they can be real assholes. I'll say it. They can be real assholes.
And then they can be great.
They can be the best.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, they are the best. That's the lead sentence. But then, you know, in there is that, yeah, but there's occasionally flashes of asshole.
Yeah.
You know.
And I know, and I talk about it in Uncle of the Year, that like I have 10 nieces and nephews, and I like to think of myself as someone who can like be cool and relate to kids. And it doesn't, like, my skill set does not always work.
Right.
Yeah. I'm not always
thinking that usually means that it's wrong.
Not happening.
The people that really can do that, they don't, you know.
No.
They don't, no. You know.
Yeah. But it's, so yeah. Yes, there was a steep learning curve when we started dating. And I think we've now, I feel like sort of found a rhythm, at least for the moment. You know, they're, you know, the kids are 10 years old, they're 10-year-old twins. So they're also on the cusp of, like, you know, becoming little tweens with, yeah, you know, all sorts of different, you know, things going on. So, but right now it's going well. We'll see how, I feel like I might be good with teenagers. I don't know. Just,
I don't know if anybody's good with teenagers, to be honest.
I think I might be good with teenagers from like the 90s. Yeah. But
I think sometimes the point of teenage years is like you're just not, as a parent, you're just not going to avoid being a jerk, you know, like being, yeah, the problem. Like, you're the problem, Dad. Like, all right, I guess I'm the problem for a few years, and you just hope that it doesn't last more than a few.
My God. I remember years ago being at my friend Jenny Connor's house. I don't think she would mind me telling the story, but she was a
producer on Girls. Yeah.
She was a co-showrunner and executive producer, and we were at her house here in LA in between seasons, and her daughter, who I think at the time must have been like 11, had some sort of fit about something and ran up to her room and went, "You bitch," and slammed the door about Jenny. And Jenny just very, yeah, calmly, she looked at me and said, "Well, that happened sooner than I thought it would." Like, she knew it was going to come at some point.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
11, she was like, maybe. But at some point, it was going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I know. I mean, my 17-year-old daughter, I, you know, when she was young, I, you know, she learned the phrase, negotiations are closed, at a very, ooh, early age.
Wow.
You know, from me, just like, I'm not going to repeat myself anymore. And I would always say, like, I don't worry about her ability to advocate for herself.
That's good.
Which was like a way of saying, like, I think that this will serve her well, but it is currently making my life miserable. you know, so it's, you have to like pull out the good points of, yep, what is the tedium and the anxiety of your current time is like, yes, but this will all be, this, yeah, is good for the future.
Absolutely. Know? Yeah. Long, yeah, term. That's good. Yes. It's a good quality.
Yeah. Well, speaking of long term, you know, this podcast is the final question of the three questions, which I think we've covered the other two, is what have you learned? And I mean, I'm sure that you get, do you have advice for young performers? Or do,
sure,
you have,
sure,
advice for, you know, young men, or advice for, you know, whatever kind of, I mean, is there something that you really feel that you've pulled from your experiences that's easily shared?
I think I wasted a lot of time, especially in my early and mid 20s, being jealous of other people, particularly professionally, being jealous of what other people had, what other people are doing, wanting to try to, you know, be like somebody else, you know, in order to achieve some level of success. And it wasn't until I was like 30, into my early 30s, that I figured out, like, just how to relax into what I do, and realizing that, like, I got to keep my eyes on my own paper and not try to keep up with whoever is around me. And I mean, and it's easier said than done, because I still, you know, I'll still see billboards here in LA and be like, why the fuck is he in that? Like, I, you know, that still comes
up. It never ends.
So I'm not trying to say, like, oh, I've healed myself. It's not that. Yeah. But those moments are fewer and short-lived. Like,
yes,
I don't flip off as many billboards as I used to while driving here. That guy. Like, I don't, that doesn't happen as often. So I feel like that's growth, Andy. I feel like that's
It certainly growth. Is, because you can't, first of all, that kind of professional envy, you know, it happens in every,
sure,
you know, every category. But like, if you're, you know, if you're selling office machinery, there's no billboards with the guy that sells more office machinery than you. You know, ours is just particularly in your face about what you didn't get.
Yeah.
But I feel like that envy is, A, it's natural. It is a bit of an engine, like mm-hmm. to keep you going.
Totally.
And so I always just feel like you got to just feel it for a minute and then let it go, because it exists. It's yeah. it's almost kind of worth it to feel it.
I mean, certainly early on, like, it did propel me forward.
Yeah.
And it did keep me sharp and keep me trying. And yeah, no, I mean, I do feel like a certain amount of that is important, and it's still important. I think it helps your ambition along and keeps you learning new skills. And, but I think I take other people's successes less personally now,
yeah.
which I spent a lot of time feeling it as like some sort of direct assault on me.
Yeah.
If someone did something better than I did or got something, like, I took it personally. Now I realize the longer you stick around, it's like everybody kind of gets a turn at some point if you're lucky and like things float up and down, and you know, you're lucky just to like be in the mix, quite honestly. So like if you stick around long enough, like you're going to hit some high moments, and you're going to watch other people hit high moments, and but it's not personal. You can't take it personally.
Right, but
you know, for a different podcast, maybe we can compare our lists sometime of our hit list.
Yes, yes. Well, Andrew Rannells, thank you so much for taking the time
to be
on this. It was great to talk to you.
It's great to talk to you too. And I hope I see you around the neighborhood.
Yeah, you probably will.
Yep, see you on the streets.
See you on the streets.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you again, Andrew. And check out the new book, Uncle of the Year, and go to the new show, Gutenberg the Musical.
That's right.
And then I want all of you out there to tune in to hear next week, where I will have another episode of this podcast. And thanks for listening. And ta-ta.
The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco production. It is produced by Sean Doherty and engineered by Rich Garcia. Additional engineering support by Eduardo Perez and Joanna Samuel. Executive produced by Nick Liao, Adam Sachs, and Jeff Ross. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, with assistance from Maddie Ogden. Research by Alyssa Grawl. Don't forget to rate and review and subscribe to The Three Questions with Andy Richter wherever you get your podcasts. And do you have a favorite question you always like to ask people? Let us know in the review section.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing? Can't you feel it? Ain't it showing? Oh, you must be a-knowing. I've got a big, big love.
This has been a Team Coco production.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.